But even though I can't speak much Spanish, because I have come here often, I think I can understand a little. And if I understood Federico, one of the things that Federico, I think, said was that there are a number of similarities between Australia and Uruguay. And that's one of the reasons that it's always such a pleasure to come back here, because I think we can learn from each other, and I certainly learn a lot from coming here on each occasion. Look, today in my talk, I'm going to be basically, the talk is divided into four parts. The first is on trends in cattle and beef prices, covering both the recent past and where they might head to in the future. The second part is about this generation known as the millennials. People basically age between 15 and 35 today. So I'll talk a bit about their requirements and their interests in food. I'm then going to deal with the strategies that we need to follow to take maximum advantage of the demand in front of us. And then finally, I'll just have a couple of slides on MLA. So first, to price trends and predictions. And I'm just a bit afraid that once you hear what I have to say, you'll think, boy, why did INAC bring him across to Uruguay? Because the picture isn't all that pretty, I don't think. It's not as good as we'd like it to be. But if you don't want to believe what I've got to say, that's okay, that's fine. And in fact, if you don't want to believe what I've got to say, I'd be in good company. Because there's been a number of famous predictions made in the world that haven't come true. I mean, 1943, the president of IBM said, I think there'll be a world market for about five computers. In 1929, a professor of economics at Yale University, 14 days before the Wall Street crash, said stocks have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. Bill Gates said 640 kilobytes ought to be enough for anyone. And Harry Warner, one of the Warner brothers in 1927, said, who in the hell wants to hear actors talk? So I might be wrong. I might be wrong with what I've got to say about prices today, but I don't think so. But you might draw some comfort that there's been plenty of people wrong in the world, and I might be wrong today as well. So let's look at the recent trends in prices and where they might be headed. You can see that from the year 2000, for the first decade basically of this century, a remarkable event occurred, truly remarkable in the history of agriculture worldwide. In the first decade of this century, prices worldwide actually increased in real terms. I mean, that was truly astonishing. It increased by about 80% for food generally. It then, over the last 3 or 4 years, has dropped about 30%. And over a long period of time, you can see that prices from the mid-1970s to last year also dropped in real terms by about 40%. So over a long period of time, they've dropped in real terms, but there was this remarkable event occur in the first decade of this century where they actually increased, an abnormal event. Basically the same pattern for beef as for food generally, and generally these food prices follow one another. For beef, again, prices increased in the first 12 years of this century, increased by about 60%, and they've gone back 20% over the last few years, And again, over a long period of time, real prices have declined. Now, boy, did that rise in real prices in the first decade of this century really cause some interest? It caused interest worldwide. I mean, these were some of the publicity. The media went berserk with this event of a rise in agricultural prices, and it's perhaps best exemplified by the headline in The Economist in December 2007, "The End of Cheap Food." Not only did the media take an interest in these events, but so did investors. And so you got all sorts of people outside agriculture starting to invest in agriculture, and pension funds starting to invest in agriculture. And this is what happened to land prices in Australia from the late 1990s to about 2008 or 9. They rose, land values, grazing land values in Australia rose about threefold, and similar patterns are to be found elsewhere in the world. I mean, there was a belief by many that the famous predictions of this man, Malthus, in terms of the world running out of food, were finally about to turn true. You know, but is this correct? Is there any basis in it? And surely the question to ask is what caused that rise in food prices, in beef prices, in the first decade of this century? And will those factors continue to operate? Well, I think there were three main factors that caused the rise in prices. One was unprecedented rises in food demand. The second was increasing use of food for energy. And the third was some commodity-specific factors such as drought and crop failures and that sort of thing. The unprecedented demand for food demand was basically driven by an unprecedented rise in world incomes. So basically, world demand for food has just got two factors that contribute to it. One is rises in population, changes in population. The other is changes in income. And in the first decade of this century, there was really quite remarkable increases in income, particularly in developing countries. You can see that GDP growth in the first decade of the century was about 2% higher than it was previously and that it's likely to be subsequently. And this was particularly so in China. I mean, the rise in income, the rise in middle class in China during this period of time was truly astonishing. And this is data from a study that McKinsey's did. And you can see from this study that in 2002, the poor represented 90% of China and the middle class represented 9%. If you add the 7 and 2 together, 9% of China. In 2012, according to McKinsey's, the poor had dropped to 29% of the population and the middle class had grown to 68%. And that caused this huge rise in demand for food and demand for meat, particularly in China. I mean, you can see from this chart that in 2005, I mean, only a decade ago, 2005, China was virtually importing zero product, zero beef. By 2015, it was importing 1.5 million tons, million tons. By 2015, it was basically the biggest beef import market in the world. And you say, well, why don't we know that? Well, I tell you why you don't know it, because most of that product still goes through the back door. It doesn't go in the front door. I mean, Australia and Uruguay have got access to the front door. India and other countries sell it through the back door, through Vietnam and through Hong Kong. So you can just imagine what impact that had on world demand for food and meat in general. You know, the fact that China went from nothing to being the biggest meat importer in the world. But there's one other factor that hugely contributed to that rise in food prices in the first decade, and of course that's use of food for fuel. I mean, you can again see the statistics here, that in the United States, the amount of corn that went into ethanol in the year 2000 was about 5%. By 2010, it was about 40%. And the US corn production in times past has acted as a buffer for world grain demand generally. And with that product going into an ethanol, it no longer could act as that buffer. And generally across the world, as you can see from the other chart here, the amount of grain, wheat and coarse grains, going into fuel rose from about 1% to 8%. So that's going to have a huge impact. That amount of food that used to go human consumption, or in some cases animal consumption, eventually human consumption, ending up as fuel. So unfortunately, the bad news is that I don't think that the factors that operated in the first decade of this century are likely to be repeated. I think that they were unique factors to the first part of this century. The rate of change in agricultural prices is basically determined by the rate of change in three factors: the rate of change in population, the rate of change in incomes over the world, and the rate of change in agricultural productivity. I mean, of course we know, it's a given that populations, bar war and famine, that populations will continue to increase and that incomes will continue to increase. But what's important is the rate of change, what's happening to the rate of change of those things versus the rate of change in agricultural productivity. And this is a story that the media missed right throughout the first decade of this century. The fact is that the rate of change, the rate of increase in the world's population is dropping. And you can see this from these statistics here. For the 25 years, 1950 to 1975, world population growth was 62%. Between 2025 and 2050, the rate of growth basically halves. It's basically dropped to 30%. I mean, what's driving that? One of the big factors that's driving that is just what's happening in China. I mean, the Chinese population, this is virtually certain now to happen, because these demographic trends have a life of their own, the Chinese population will start dropping. It won't increase anymore, it will start dropping from about 2030 onwards. So populations will drop, and as I said before, I think the first decade was remarkable in terms of income growth. and it's likely that income growth will drop as well. These are figures from the OECD, and the OECD forecasts are that world income growth will drop. Why do you think that is the case? Well, it's obvious. I mean, the world is aging. We've got an older population. And of course, an older population means less people of working age. That's basically why world incomes will drop. And again, China is incredibly important in this regard. And again, these are OECD forecasts. You can see that it's going to drop from about 10% in between 2001 and 2007 to about 3% in 2030 to 2050. So, you know, given those trends, it's hardly surprising that the rate of increase, food demand will increase, but the rate of increase will go backwards, will drop. And these are forecasts from the FAO, again, completely missed in the hysterical coverage of the rise in food prices in the first decade of this century. The FAO predict that the rate of increase in world food demand will drop. And you can do the figures. I mean, to meet the expected increase in food demand, agricultural productivity generally, across all agriculture, has to increase by about 1% a year. For meat, it's got to increase by about 1.4% a year. And historically, and based on current trends, those figures in productivity improvements are very achievable. So if you get agricultural productivity above those amounts, prices will fall on average. So the melancholy conclusion is that real agricultural prices, including for beef, I don't think are likely to increase, and they may even drop, as they have already done over the last 3 or 4 years. But for INAC to give me the speaking engagement, in fact, I want to do this anyway. I want to indicate what we must do to meet that likely drop in prices. And I think there's two things that we must do. One is work on the demand side, and the other is work on the productivity side. I mean, there's this wonderful generation that I talked about right at the beginning. These millennials. This wonderful generation that was basically born between about 1980 and the turn of the century. That are already a powerful force in the world. I mean, across the world generally, they already represent 25% of the world's population. And they represent 25% of the population in the richest country in the world, the United States. And they've got a different outlook in life. They've got a different outlook in life than I have, and they've got a different outlook in life than many of you have. I mean, they're interested in food. They go out to eat twice as often as the baby boomers, people of my generation. For the first time ever, look at this second point. For the first time ever, they're spending more on food than they are on clothes. I mean, for these millennials, food is identity. Food is self-branding. Food is social currency. It's important in their lives. And in researching for this talk, I came across this graphic, which rather tickled my fancy. I mean, for millennials, a burrito isn't just a burrito. A burrito is a boiled wrap, handcrafted, local farm supporting, food culture changing cylinder of deliciousness. I mean, if it's marketed right, that's the sort of impression that you can make on millennials. They're interested in food and they're knowledge seekers. I mean, 75% want to know more about food production, 50% want to know how beef is raised. And grass-fed is one of the trends amongst these millennials. And you can go and search that on the internet and it will say it on the internet. I mean, what they want is authenticity, hence grass-fed. They want transparency. They want to learn more about the process. They want food with a story. Food with a story. So doesn't that create opportunities? Doesn't that create branding opportunities? Doesn't that create the possibility for farmers to get more involved in the marketing and the production of their food? It creates greater possibilities than ever before, in my belief, for branding of food products. And this was a trend that we had to go through in the meat industry anyway. I mean, we need to brand our product far more than it is and make those brands important. And millennials provide us with that opportunity. So the keys to success then. Well, I think they're basically five, and I probably could have written a few more, but basically I wanted to limit it to five. So market knowledge, product integrity, value for money, market access, and branding. Starting with market knowledge, and you know, I mean, I hardly tell you that that's a foundation attribute for success in any area of business. You've got to know your business, you've got to know your customers, you've got to know where markets are trending, you've got to know your competitors. I mean, you've got to know everything there is to know about anything. And I mean, in Australia we have this saying, in God we trust, for everything else, bring data. Product integrity. Again, a cornerstone for success. And product integrity doesn't just mean food safety and traceability. Of course, that's at the very core of product integrity. You've got to be have maximum levels of food safety. You've got to have traceability. But product integrity means standing up to any claim you're making about the product. So if you're making a claim that the product's got to be grass-fed, to be authentic, like the millennials want, it's got to be grass-fed, and you've got to be able to prove it's grass-fed. If you're saying it's halal, it's got to meet all the requirements of halal. If you're grading it in a certain way, that those grades have to be transparent and authentic. Of course, we've got to continue to provide value for money. And you know, you might say that we're maxed out as an industry in productivity. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. There's plenty more productivity improvements we can make of an industry. I mean, for a start, we know that the average producers aren't nearly as good as the top producers. I mean, this is data from Australia once again, and you can see for operating margin that the top producers, the top 25 producers in Northern Australia, are basically making twice the operating margin as the average producer. So, you know, there's plenty of improvement for a start for average producers to catch up with top producers. And then there's room for top producers to further improve. I mean, these are the disease costs in the cattle industry in Australia. Ticks and buffalo fly and other things. And you add those all up and they come to $1 billion a year in round terms. I mean, the Australian industry is only worth $11 billion a year. So it's about 10% about our production is going in disease costs. And we probably do better than many parts in the world. But, you know, through further research, we can and we will reduce these costs. And then finally, an incredibly important area, both for branding, the branding direction that we want to go, and for productivity improvements, is supply chain integration. I mean, the chicken industry did it years ago, the pork industry done it years ago. We as an industry worldwide need to increase supply chain integration. And we need to start paying on the basis of an animal's true worth. Now again, this is data for Australia, but I'm sure that I'm absolutely certain that would be replicated here. And this is the meat value from animals, a group of 16 animals in Australia. And to be honest, I mean, you look at a picture of these animals, these 16 animals, and they look like peas in a pod. So they were all Herefords. They came out of Southern Australia, similar carcass weights, similar conformation. You'd think that they would dress out and their meat quality would be quite similar. But it's meat quality and saleable yield, and the distribution of that yield amongst the cuts, the loin cuts versus the other cuts in the animal, that are so important in affecting the true value of that animal. And you can see in this chart the enormous differences from about $5 carcass weight to $3 carcass weight in the true value of animals that look very similar. And you might say, well, you got some rat bags in that mob of 16. But if you look at the fifth last point, you can see that even between the second and the fifth last point, which look quite similar, there's still $100 difference. I mean, $100, that's huge. I mean, we can do so much better by paying for the true worth of animals rather than paying on averages. Market access, look, I won't say much about this. I mean, we probably in Australia do better than you do because we've done free trade agreements with Japan, Korea, China, over the last 5 years, but we've still got plenty of work to do in market access, and particularly with Fortress Europe, as this chart represents. And finally, the branding. Such an important area, as I said. I mean, partly branding involves business development, knowing your customers, turning leads into prospects, into customers. Partly it involves country of origin branding, the sort of branding that, you know, does, and I love your logo, by the way. When I first saw it years ago, I thought it was a fantastic logo with the grass and the traceability element there. I just thought it was very, very clever. But of course, this is data from Japan about the percentage of females that take notice of country of origin. And what is it? It's 90% of females in Japan, when they go into a shop, look at the country of origin. And that data is replicated around the world. We all look at where the products come from. So you need not only a good image for your brand, you need a good image for the country that brand originates in. You need tight specifications. And I think that with branding, with differentiation, the sorts of demands that these new generations want, there's real opportunities to provide different product. So what we want to do is get away from this notion that beef is beef. We want it to be a variety of things, satisfying a variety of desires. And one of the initiatives that we've done in Australia is now create this certified pasture fed. So, you know, farmers that supply this under this specification, they people go on their farms and they get audited. It's got to be 100% grass fed. It's got to meet even quality standards. and it's got to have no HGPs. I know you don't use them down here anyway. And it's got to be free of antibiotics. You can use topical antibiotics, but you can't inject them or feed them antibiotics. And we're getting 10 to 20% premiums for that sort of product. We're selling it into the United States in the high-end supermarkets in the United States to no doubt a lot of millennial consumers, because that's the sort of thing they want. That's the sort of thing they want. And those are the directions that we want to go. And then, of course, there's company brands. And one of the things my old company does, Meat and Livestock Australia, with levy money, it actually supports these company brands. So companies come to us, packers come to MLA and say, look, we want to undertake these initiatives, these promotion initiatives for our brand, and we'll support those initiatives as well as doing our country of origin brand. So finally, just a couple of words about Meat and Livestock Australia. And as I said, I worked for this company around about for 25 years, and I just thought it might be interesting for you to know some of the differences and some similarities between Meat and Livestock Australia and NA. First of all, levies in Australia, they're a bit different here. Some years ago, in the late 1980s, we went to a cattle transaction levy. So every time cattle are sold in Australia, a $5 levy per head is paid on those cattle. And you can see that most of that money goes to MLA, which surged 92 cents, marketing $3.66. But some of it goes to a residue testing survey that the government does, and some of it goes to Animal Health Australia. That $5 levy for MLA generates about US$60 million, $25 million used for R&D, and the government put in 50% of the R&D funds, $35 million for marketing. I guess where MLA is different from INAC is that MLA is owned by producers. Back in the late 1990s, we had organisations that were owned by government, as INAC is, but MLA is owned by producers. It's actually a private company with 50,000 cattle and sheep members. We hold an AGM, or MLA holds an AGM each year. Producers elect the board members. They may choose to vote on levies, either that levies should increase or that levies should go down. And in about 2008, they voted that levies should be increased from $3.50 to $5. There's independent assessments taken of MLA's work every 5 years, and benefit cost analyses working on that. And then finally, there's voting rates are determined by the amount of levies that are paid. Just a final thing that I want to mention is that MLA, together with the Processing Corporation, own an organisation called AusMeat that does some of the work that INAC does. So it's the owner of the language that's used to describe Australian meat. It goes in and audits meat processing plants and makes sure that they're using that language correctly. And finally, it ensures that proper feedback is provided to producers based on the animals that they're selling to the processors. So look, that's all I wanted to say. I don't know how long I've talked to be honest, just over 30 minutes, so that's good. Thank you very much for having us here.